This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Even here in the United States, although we tend to not want to admit it, but you know, this economy in a lot of ways depends upon a strong oil and gas industry in order to feed a very strong economy.
Fossil fuel is sort of a dirty word in environmental circles, but it still comprises over 80% of the world's energy consumption. This week on Sea Change Radio, oil expert Daniel Dicker explains the complex role that oil and gas plays in the world's economy. First, we take a look at the recent OPEC meetings and the effect that they'll have on oil prices moving forward. Then we get a snapshot of the challenges that the major oil-producing countries face today. Lastly, we get a glimpse into how oil markets are reacting to the inevitable transition to renewable energy. I'm joined once again on Sea Change Radio by oil expert Daniel Dicker. Dan, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Always good to be on your show.
Why don't you give us a quick recap of the recent OPEC meetings and what that might mean for future oil prices?
Yeah, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds for your listeners because this is really going to bore the heck out of them while it excites me. But what happened recently, the most important thing that happened recently, is that the Saudis have given up the ghost in trying to keep the price low by flooding a market, and in doing so, trying to force most American independent shale players out of business. And that is a policy that they basically began in late 2014, forced oil prices down below $30 a barrel. And what happened since then was that American oil companies, despite having a very hard go of it financially, have been very resilient, managed to survive, managed to cut costs, have managed to lower their break-even point for oil in several of the shale areas we talk about here in the United States. And in essence, the Saudis have been, on balance, unsuccessful at driving a good portion of these shale players out of business. So what in late September, an announcement from the oil minister in Algiers was that the Saudis were now prepared to have a production guideline, production limits, for OPEC barrels, basically cutting a 500,000 barrels a day, which is not in itself significant, but the idea that the Saudis are now ready to not continually flood the market with oil and in fact are prepared to see a production limit go into place for all of OPEC, including themselves, that's a sea change for the OPEC cartel and for global oil supply.
So A, why are the Saudis more powerful within OPEC? And B, why is OPEC not as powerful as it was 30, 40 years ago?
Well, the reason that they're still powerful inside of OPEC is because they are still the major producer. They produce upwards of close to 11 million barrels a day of a total OPEC output of a little over 33 million barrels a day. So you have one-third of all production that comes online from OPEC, from the Saudis. They also have the greatest capability to adjust that production number because most of the other members of OPEC are completely reliant, and not that the Saudis aren't, but they are totally reliant upon what they get from oil revenues to support an economy. Now, why aren't they as powerful as they were in the 70s? Well, that's also clear. There have been a whole bunch of what we call alternative or non-traditional sources of energy that have popped up. The one that's gotten the most press is shale oil, but there have been other sources of oil. Deep water oil has increased in technology. Tar sands oil, for example, from Canada and from Venezuela has increased in importance. And the Russians have increased in importance in the oil that they produce. So on a global sphere, the percentage of oil that OPEC delivers to the global supply chain is significantly less than they did in the 70s, but still inside OPEC, the Saudis are the most dominant by far.
And to give context to that one-third number that the Saudis produce, there are 12 members of OPEC, is that correct?
Yes.
But that does not include Canada and Russia, correct?
Canada and Russia are not members of OPEC, no.
And how would they stack up if they were members of OPEC, those two countries?
The Russians would be number one. Their oil production is a little over 11 million barrels a day at this point. America would be number three, by the way, a bit over 9 million barrels a day of oil. And if you add natural gas to the mix, America has become the largest producer of fossil fuels in the world. And Canada is, depending on who you listen to, somewhere around 4.5 million barrels a day, somewhere in the neighborhood of where Iraq is right now.
Thus, OPEC is not as powerful as it was 40 years ago because Canada, Russia, and the U.S. were not producing as big a chunk of the world's energy supply as they are today. Is that fair to say?
It is, but you got to remember that the oil supply demand kind of continuum is on a kind of a razor's edge. And when you control, in a cartel situation, a third of the global supply, that's enough to move the price of oil anywhere you want it to go.
And as prices have come way down from where they were a couple years ago, how has that affected demand?
Well, demand in general has been on the same trajectory for as the, you know, irrespective of price. It's not been one of those things where you would think that you know, the normal rules of economic 101 apply. You know, if prices go down, all of a sudden demand goes up. It's really been something. It's been a very inelastic commodity and has been for generations. You know, the world needs what it needs. Price becomes almost secondary. Although, you know, here in the United States, for example, there are outliers on that. For example, in this country, gasoline consumption has gone way up during the summer because obviously gas prices have been low. That's been one case where you've seen energy prices react to the, you know, a standard price supply demand curve. But for the global marketplace, it's been more, you know, there's a general amount of economic expansion or economic contraction, and that generates the demand structure of oil irrespective of price for the most part. Since the 1950s, oil demand has gone up basically 10 million barrels a day every 10 years like clockwork.
And let's put some of the prices in context for our listeners who don't have charts in front of them. Just give us some of the bellwether moments from since, let's say, 1975, when we had lines around the block to pump gas in the U.S. So what was oil priced at in like 1974?
In the 70s, we had a move up to $30, which at that time was unheard of.
Right.
Because oil was basically priced somewhere around $10 or $11 a barrel. And most of that was going into the pockets of U.S. oil companies, including the big three here in the United States, as much of the framework of relationships with the Middle East were based on U.S. technology.
And then all of a sudden in March of 1974, I'm looking at it here, I'm cheating a little bit, sorry, it shoots up to $50 a barrel out of nowhere.
Right. And that's, you know, comes from a obviously a U.S.-Israeli connection and the Saudis trying to, and OPEC trying to get in the middle of that connection and boycotting the United States in terms of an oil supply. And, you know, Nixon did very well in turning the tables on the Saudis then, but that's really ancient history. So you have that, and then prices settled down for a very long time after that, for the most part staying between $16, $12, and about $21 a barrel till about 2003.
So almost 20 years.
Right. And I wrote a book on what changed, you know, in 2000 or going into 2003 and on through 2000 and 2008 in my first book called Oil's Endless Bid, where, you know, I posited that it was the growth of financial derivatives and the interest in financial engineering of commodities that had forced oil to go up basically, you know, in essence, 10 times of its price in the course of 6 or 7 years. So in 2007, we reached the pinnacle of that right before the financial collapse in toto of a price above $145 a barrel. And that was followed in the collapse of 2008 to a low price of $32 a barrel at the depths of the financial crisis. Since that moment, we were on a steady rise again to the tune of, we got close to $120 a barrel during the Libya crisis in 2010. And then finally in 2014, after meandering, you know, around this $100 to $110 area, finally we saw the increased production from shale and other places finally turn the tide on in terms of supply in a marketplace and overloading and glutting a supply. And in 2014, late 2014, we saw prices go from over $100 a barrel to a low of $27 a barrel in February of this year. So that's where we're coming from. We're now around $50 a barrel. And, you know, in my view, there's been enough of a destruction of investment into future oil recovery and a number of oil companies that are going to be a little less aggressive in the way that they go after oil over the next couple of years, that, you know, I personally think we're going to see $110 a barrel again as soon as 2017.
There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to oil expert Daniel Dicker. He writes for Real Money, and he also hosts webinars at Energy Word. So we've been, for the last couple of years, in this band of, in terms of oil prices, of $30 to $60 per barrel, correct?
Yeah, since late last year, it's been right around there, yeah.
And we know what that means for drivers, but what does it mean for the world economy when oil prices are in this level?
You know, I'm in a very, very interesting place when it comes to trying to understand the economic impact of low oil prices. I'm usually on the other side from most other economists who will claim up and down that low oil prices are a tremendous boon to the consumer. And I just don't see it, and I've never seen it. I do know that very low oil prices have a very destabilizing impact on those economies that depend upon oil revenues in order to stay alive. We look at Venezuela, we look at Nigeria, we look at Libya, we look at Saudi Arabia, we look at Iran, we look at Iraq, you know, we look at the Russians.
We hear the resource curse, right?
Exactly. And you know, even here in the United States, although we tend to not want to admit it, but, you know, this economy in a lot of ways depends upon, you know, a strong oil and gas industry in order to feed a very strong economy. A lot of what's been happening in our economy in terms of slow growth, I put down to low oil and gas prices. These, what we've lost over the course of the last year, have been 150,000 jobs. And it's not like, you know, 150,000 jobs like McDonald's jobs, or they've been engineering jobs, they've been mining jobs, they've been chemicals jobs, they've been, you know, upper middle class jobs, you know, that most of them deliver six-figure salaries to families and have been a big growth prospect that's been lost. Now, it sounds like, you know, I'm a big advocate for big oil, which I am not, but from an economic standpoint and from what I see, you know, a robust American oil and gas industry feeds this economy, not to the same degree that it does the Saudis, or not, and certainly not to the same degree that it does the Russians, but it does, in fact, feed a very, very strong economy, as opposed to the other side of the coin of what we get in terms of consumer spending because people are, let's say, you know, spending a dollar less a gallon for gas.
And let's now talk about how this new reality of $30 to $60 oil that we've been getting accustomed to the last couple of years has affected renewable energy growth.
When oil is cheap, it's a heck of a lot cheaper to use fossil fuels than to use renewable energy. And that's just the bottom line. As much as the efficiencies on solar have increased over the last 4 years, and they have, they are still not even within eyeshot of the efficiency of natural gas when natural gas is going for $3, you know, an MCF, or when oil is trading for $50 a barrel. It's not even close.
What would those numbers have to be close?
They'd have to be almost double with oil to get into the ballpark, or a little more than double for natural gas to get into the ballpark. And that's with the technology we're dealing with right now, which is why all of those that talk about renewables talk about governmental incentives, which are absolutely necessary at every stage of this in order to move the ball forward, no matter where oil and gas are, because you just, even if it was on an even playing field, oil and gas and solar, for example, you wouldn't get the kind of progress with renewables that you really would want to see, because the infrastructure for the oil and gas business is so much deeper than solar, and they have a vested interest in keeping things the status quo. So it just makes it that much more difficult to move the ball down the road that we need to on renewables with the way that the pricing is right now. And of course, you know, the Republican candidate for president doesn't help either. I mean, he wants to go backwards. He wants to, you know, he wants to reinvigorate the coal industry, for God's sakes. You know, he wants to go to 1875 in terms of U.S. energy supply.
Yeah, it's pretty stunning when he's talking about clean coal, like this is a viable alternative to add to our current mix.
It's a bizarre point of view. It's the kind of thing, it's like I'm expecting the next statement to be, and after we finish with clean coal, we're going to start burning wood again, and we're going to use horse-drawn carriages in the cities. It's entirely in reverse of the natural order of how energy and how everybody thinks. Everybody, even those in the oil and gas business, believe that the energy portfolio has to move going forward. Everybody knows. Everybody. Is aware of a renewable future. Everybody, even the CEO of Exxon, believe me.
Maybe you could speak to the talking point that a lot of people hear about but don't necessarily dig deep into, and that's the subsidies that oil and gas companies have benefited from for the last 100 years.
When the United States moved from being a wood-based energy society to a coal-based energy society, there were huge tax incentives given to the coal companies in order to increase their ability to go down in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and mine. And that was done because you cannot, it's not free to do any kind of E&P, exploration and production, in any energy source without some help. It costs too much money to start. This was the same idea that was brought forward when this country moved from a coal-based society into a fossil fuels-based society, the remnants of which we talk about all the time when we talk about those tax advantages that are given to the major oil companies, which clearly they don't need anymore. But those are the remnants of those same incentives that were given to the coal industry in the 1870s and were given to the oil industry in the 1950s. And they're just a remnant of that. Now, to argue at this point, that the United States is not any more willing to deliver those kinds of incentives into renewable fuels is ridiculous. You know, the argument always comes that this is a wasted, you know, incentive, and to pour it in, and someone will drop the name Solyndra on you.
Oh yes, you always have to hear Solyndra because that was the red herring that not every investment worked perfectly.
Right, not every investment works perfectly. Well, guess what? That's the way. Not every investment works perfectly in the oil and gas business when it started out either. But it's an important and necessary directive of the federal government to help new energy sources do the kind of E&P work And for solar, that means research and development with huge incentives, because they've done it for everybody else, and they have to continue to do that, and that has not been pressed forward at all. Forgetting about the Republicans, even the Obama administration has been very, very wary since Solyndra of pushing that forward. And the incentives that have been delivered to renewables over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, for the most part, have fallen in the hands of the major oil companies. They haven't fallen in the hands of those who are really moving forward with renewables. And that is, to me, a crying shame, and should be pointed out, and hasn't been pointed out.
Can you give us an example of some of those oil and gas incentives?
For those who are actually on the forefront, who are trying to develop truly new renewable sources of energy, it's been a very, very difficult go. And one of the reasons for that is because you never know whether these incentives are going to be renewed or not, and at what level they're going to be renewed. So if you're an established company and you're already doing fossil fuel E&P, and you want to get some incentives for doing a little bit something that's sort of on the fringe you might consider to be alternative, well, you can go and you can get your tax write-off or your credits, and if things don't work out and they cut your credits off, you go back to your basic business. But if you're trying to start a business and develop a business based on an alternative fuel source, and you don't know whether those incentives and tax breaks will be delivered over the course of the next 5, 10, 15 years, but are only good for the next 2, you've got a big problem in deciding whether you're going to go forward with that business.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to oil expert Dan Dicker. So Dan, let's turn to natural gas for a second. We've spoken several times in it, and we always heard about how unless oil was over $80 a barrel, these shale and natural gas producers are not going to survive. Now, many have fallen by the wayside, but the flow has not ceased. Why don't you give us a heat check, if you will, on what's happening in the U.S. domestic production market of natural gas and shale?
Yeah, and as I started, you know, I started the conversation with you by saying, you know, that the Saudis were surprised and had to back off from their, you know, their market share strategy because the U.S. companies showed a lot more resilience than they thought they would, and more than I thought they would. When I wrote my second book in 2014, I had estimated that there would be, well, forgetting about a number, let's put it this way, a heck of a lot more bankruptcy and bond default going on in the oil and gas industry, and it just hasn't happened. Now, there have been well over 100 bankruptcies of small E&P companies in oil and gas, but I expected to see like a wholesale destruction of you know, what we call mini majors, the companies that were, you know, that had market caps in the billions.
And to what do you attribute that discrepancy in your analysis?
It's been, you know, a couple of things. It's been one, a very, very fast reaction time this time from the oil companies to actually cut, you know, costs. They did that almost immediately, and they got a lot of cooperation from the oil services companies to do that. Two, they managed to find technologies practically overnight to increase efficiencies in what they were already doing. So if you had a place where you were drilling and basically you needed to get it out of the ground to break even with an oil price of $55 a barrel, they managed to get their break-evens down to $40 a barrel. So all of a sudden, stuff that was not going to make them any money at least was breaking even under very, very bad oil price market. So that's two. The third was there was an enormous resource of extra capital that remained at their disposal throughout the oil bust, which surprised me. I mean, there were a lot of investors that lost a lot of money when oil dropped from over 100 to down near 30 or under 30. But it didn't stop the appetite for people to invest in oil price and oil companies, because they knew, as well as I did, that the oil price in the 30s was unsustainable and was more than likely, was almost inevitable that it was going to rally back. So during the entire bust cycle, there were just huge investor groups, private equity firms with billions of dollars, and other investors who were waiting for any chance to invest back in, pour money back into companies that looked like they were going to go bankrupt, but in fact, you know, just kept on getting, you know, the cash to survive. And that continues today.
So we often talk about how externalities in fossil fuels affect us in many ways, that we can't necessarily put a price tag on fossil fuels when you consider pollution and the effect it has on climate change, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems like governments are now coming around to this reality and pricing in externalities a little bit more. We see the Paris Agreement and other pretty aggressive climate change legislation coming from many countries. And homeowners and consumers are starting to think about the realities of their decisions more. Solar penetration rates are rising. People are buying more energy efficient vehicles, even with low gas prices. What needs to happen to have the third part of that tree to really take into account externalities, that is the markets and investing class?
Oh God, Alex, I've spent a lifetime trying to figure that out, and so far I really haven't figured that out. I am heartened by certain things that I see. President Obama, for example, saying that he's going to commit his post-presidential life to climate change. That to me is a very, very big deal. I thought Hurricane Sandy was going to be that turning point. I really did. And I'm less convinced that it was that now. I see things change like you do. I mean, I see the same things you see. But what moves Wall Street into finally embracing the future? I don't know.
I guess the question would be, those people who are seeing opportunity in $40 oil, what could make them think that ethically it may not be such a great opportunity for us to be buying stocks in things that could lead to our downfall in the end?
I wish I could tell you that I have a lot of faith in, you know, the morality of investors, but, you know, a lifetime of being in the financial world has left me with the opposite conclusion. And there will be a change for the investor when alternative energy makes them at least as much money as oil and gas does now. And I don't know when that happens.
Well, I always enjoy the conversation. Dan Dicker, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Chris Joss, Randy Newman, and Fred McDowell. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.